Hi, and welcome to It's Complicated, a podcast about healthcare ethics and practice presented by the Nova Scotia Health Ethics Network, or NSHEN. I'm Marika Warren, network ethicist for NSHEN, and I'll be your host for this discussion. Today I'm joined by Francis Bakewell, who is, among other things, an emergency medicine physician working in the Central Zone in Halifax, Nova Scotia. Today we're following up on a discussion that was started at the 2025 Fred Barton Lecture in the Department of Bioethics at Dalhousie University. The theme for the lecture was trust and distrust in the healthcare system, and Francis raised some really interesting points in the panel discussion related to trust and distrust between healthcare providers, and we wanted to take an opportunity to follow up on those. So perhaps to start us off, Francis, you can give us some examples of the experiences that reflect relationships of trust and distrust between healthcare providers.
Sure. So I would argue really that every interaction between healthcare providers that involves patient care in some way is going to involve some element of trust or distrust. So it's probably far more widespread, and the examples are anytime we're talking to each other. The reason I think that is if when we look at how we define trust and distrust in generally speaking kind of sociological literature, and then more specifically in healthcare, the more general definition that tends to be accepted is one's willingness to increase one's vulnerability to another person whose behavior is not under one's control. But we define it more specifically in the literature on trust between healthcare providers, trust being a positive expectation that the other provider is going to act professionally and prioritize patient needs. So we really have that expectation every time we interact. And then conversely, the negative expectation that they won't fulfill that responsibility would be distrust. Sometimes mistrust and distrust are used interchangeably or used differently. Sometimes mistrust is more of a vague distrust of an entire system. It's broader, with distrust being more of a specific, targeted, individual level lack of trust. I'll probably use them interchangeably when it comes to healthcare providers. So really, you know, the highest risk situations where we're going to see it are going to be anytime there is a transfer of care responsibility. So consults or other transfers of care. But even in environments where it's established that you're going to work together and collaborate on care, and that's the assumption. You can think of something like an operating room, for example, where there's many different moving parts and many different team members. You can still see trust and distrust manifest in those environments, even though the responsibility might be fairly diffused. You can see it in interprofessional relationships between different types of providers. But you can also see it within professions, especially if it's members coming from different silos. So just to offer some maybe, you know, concrete examples of what that might look like, when we think about what trust looks like, you can imagine, for example, a consultant in the community who consistently receives consults from a family doctor that they think are well investigated and timely and well differentiated. And the next time they get a consult that isn't like that, they're probably more willing to give that family doctor the benefit of the doubt. You can think as well of a pharmacist who's working on a hospital ward team who has worked with a physician before on some kind of QI project, and they're probably going to feel more willing to, let's say, question an order from that physician without fear of blowback from them. And then conversely, when we think of examples of distrust, especially around, again, those sort of transfers of care, you can imagine a resident who's working in the middle of the night on a hospital floor, their patient compensates, they call the ICU for consideration of transferring there, and the ICU fellow comes and sees them and says, oh, they're not sick enough yet to come to me. And it's possible that that might be true, but the person who's doing the consulting in the middle of the night might think, well, maybe you're making that decision because you feel your beds are under threat and you don't have enough space to accept my patient, so you're not actually meeting the patient expectations. So those are some of the examples of where we see it, where it's very obvious, but I think to some degree it's present in every interaction.
So yeah, then that strikes me that this is a really important conversation to have, given, you know, you mentioned essential nature of trust for collaboration and the way that we're really focusing on providing collaborative care throughout the healthcare system. So what are some of the things that facilitate the development of relationships of trust that then help that collaboration along? And what are some of the barriers that, you know, might get in the way of establishing those sorts of trusting relationships that are necessary for effective collaboration.
So again, you can look at trust and some of these factors at a much broader kind of sociologic definition that's longstanding and been used beyond just the realm of medicine. And the classic sort of pillars of trust there are things like competence, benevolence, and expectation that the other person, the trustee, actually wants to do the right thing. Integrity, some sense of wholeness of a belief system and adherence to that belief system in your actions. And then often people add on predictability, a clear pattern that's existed before, and even direct assurance from the trustee that they're going to fulfill the responsibility. But those are quite broad, and we can look at the healthcare literature with regards to trust and distrust between providers and really drill down to some very more specific, I think, and concrete things. And what that looks like is protective factors are good and established relationships between healthcare providers, the provision of expert and competent care on both sides of that trust dynamic, empathy and engagement with not only the issue at hand, but with the other person's working environment and pressures, active collaboration, and present or at least synchronous communication between providers. And so conversely, the absence of all those things is what defines a distrustful relationship. So a bad or even just an unknown reputation, doubt in the other person's competence, any evidence of disengagement with the issue at hand, of self-serving behaviors, not putting the patient first, failure to collaborate, and poor or absent communication.
So in both cases, it's patterns that often shape some of what our expectations are going into any new encounter, and sort of have those patterns been sort of beneficial or have they been detrimental in the past, then sort of conditions us in a certain way going forward. So those, you mentioned relationships as a really key part, and I'm curious in your experience as to, you know, what are some of the things that build those relationships, again, in ways that facilitate trust?
Well, again, I mean, the biggest impact probably is on an individual level, at least, is on having some kind of relationship. And as systems get bigger and bigger, those relationships obviously become harder and harder to come by. And as we get more and more siloed in the care that we provide, those relationships are harder and harder to come by and less easy to rely on, which gets to what I think is also a really big and possibly at this point the biggest impact on the phenomenon of distrust in medicine. Which is the increasing silo system that we have, which I would argue is a result largely of resource scarcity. And so we see, you know, as resources dwindle, providers become more and more protective of their own patients and their own silos, and any request for care or accommodation or collaboration can be viewed sometimes as a threat to your ability to provide care for the patients that you're already responsible for. And so unfortunately, all of those protective factors that I listed, so established reputations, active collaborations, physical or at least that synchronous presence when communicating, and the inability to provide that competent care, all of those things are going to be at risk in the setting of resource scarcity. You don't have the time or the opportunity to meet face to face. There's limited time or options to collaborate. There's a greater emphasis on sharing kind of sharp handoffs of care and transitions of care, and this is your problem now. And there's a limited ability, obviously, to then be physically or synchronously present, even in having a phone conversation, along with the fact that just that the standard of care may not be getting delivered at any level. And so what we see is that distrust levels rise, not as a result of individual failings. The providers are all trying to do their best in that system, but because of these systemic failings. And the issue there is that distrust sticks to the provider in really what is, I think, a form of attribution bias, where we are overestimating their ethical failings, and we are not paying enough attention to the external factors that are driving that situation. And unfortunately, we know that distrust is very sticky. So even when the situation might improve temporarily, those resource pressures lessen, the distrust between providers in different silos is going to stick around. We come to expect our colleagues to act unprofessionally and to deprioritize patient needs, because that resource scarcity mindset is also very difficult to get rid of.
So there's a lot there that I want to touch on. So I think I might put a pin in the moment in some of the system questions, but I do want to return to those. But before looking at that, I'm curious, you know, in terms of, you know, patients and their loved ones as, you know, those who are receiving care, sort of how do those relationships of trust and distrust, sort of both on the individual and systemic levels, how do they affect the experiences that patients and their loved ones have when they seek care?
So we do have actually some evidence on this, on specifically how inter-provider trust and distrust affects patient care. I mean, there's an enormous amount of literature on patient trust and distrust in providers and how that affects care. But we've, over the past couple of decades, increasingly looked at the effect on patients from that relationship between providers. Mostly what we have evidence of is the positive effects of a trusting relationship between providers in healthcare settings, but there are some indirect evidence of the negative impacts that can happen. So trust between providers has been shown to increase knowledge sharing, to increase innovation behaviors in either new technologies or new processes in healthcare organizations, to increase commitment to those organizations, and to increase provider job satisfaction, which I think at least has some impact probably at the patient level. And then conversely, there have been some smaller studies, as I say, looking at the negative impacts that show some reductions in work focus, reductions in efficiency, and increased stress. There's one study that looked at comparing high and low functioning nursing units as defined by whether they were meeting kind of predetermined benchmarks of care, which found that the higher performing units were clearly marked by higher levels of trust. In fact, that was the defining feature of them compared to the low functioning units. And then I think we can draw slightly more oblique conclusions from some of the evidence around teamwork, where healthcare teams that score high on measures of teamwork show better patient outcomes, sometimes including mortality outcomes, fewer adverse errors, reduced healthcare costs. So these aren't studies that look at trust explicitly, but trust has been shown to be one of the key elements of teamwork.
In terms of thinking about some of the ethics pieces, certainly any, you know, effects on the experiences of patients and their loved ones has an ethical component. But I'm curious as to what some of the other ethical aspects of trust and distrust are from your perspective. I think you've hit on a few things, but I'm wondering if you want to sort of bring those together. So sort of why might we be worried about trust and distrust from the specifically ethics lens?
Yeah, I think there's ethical concerns both in terms of causes of that distrust and then also the effects of the distrust. So in terms of cause, I mean, outside of those main pillars that I listed, ethical lapses are often identified as being a source of distrust. They probably generally are classified under that integrity component. But these are things like breaking of confidentiality between providers, a lack of discretion, dishonesty, a lack of accountability. You see one frequent example coming up in the literature, which is physicians blaming nurses for what was actually their error in care. So that can certainly be an issue in terms of cause. And then in terms of the effects, the ethical implications as a result of distrust between providers, I think there are concerns regardless of whether the distrust is quote unquote justified on the individual level or whether, as I'm arguing, it might be unjustified from systemic factors. If mistrust or distrust of a provider is justified, then the ethical concern is there's clearly been some kind of flag for that trustee's behavior, their professionalism, their competency, or their reliability. So if that goes on unchecked or unaddressed, the question becomes why hasn't that been corrected and why has that distrust just been allowed to fester? If the distrust is, as I would argue in a lot of cases, unjustified and is a result of attribution bias from systemic issues, then the ethical concerns are, I think, even more. So first, a provider is being unjustly distrusted. By definition, the resulting treatment by the truster is going to be unfair. Second, the underlying systemic issues are being given a pass in a sense, as the issue is being kind of downgraded or downloaded onto the individual level. And so we're failing to address what is truly threatening patients. And then third, as mentioned, from all of those sort of patient outcomes, the resulting patient care is inevitably going to be affected just by virtue of the presence of distrust, all other things being equal. And again, I think without any valid cause in a lot of cases.
And it strikes me, too, that from a healthcare system perspective, that the effects on healthcare providers in terms of their own sense of professionalism, integrity, particularly in the experience of unjustified distrust, that there must also be sort of ethical concerns that arise there, too, around sort of how the system is treating those who are working within it to provide care. So there's a lot of reasons, I think, for us to be concerned about this. Coming back to the line that distrust is sticky, which I think is a really useful metaphor, I'm wondering as to sort of where and how you see it sticking sort of between members of a team. So you mentioned, there's a tendency of sometimes, physicians blaming nurses. But do you see it sticking more to sort of members of other professions, or does distrust often sort of adhere to sort of members of the same profession to a greater degree?
So I wasn't able to find in my kind of reading of the literature on this topic any direct comparison that would quantify which was more prominent, whether it's between members of the same profession or whether it's across different professions in healthcare. I think it can clearly exist in both. So you might see it, between nurses, for example, on different units who have to share some transition of care on their patients. But you might see it within a team, let's say between physicians and nurses, depending on reputation of that individual. And again, those reputations stick and they get around. I'd say in my own experience, what's probably more important, however, than the profession that one belongs to is the silo that one belongs to. And so I think you'll see much higher levels of distrust across silos, regardless of whether that person identifies as the same profession as you do.
So yeah, it's flowing in a lot of different directions there, but interesting to sort of think about, again, what influences where sort of the distrust is landing. And again, like you say, whether that's fair or not. So to come back to the sort of fairness at that system level, I'm wondering what your thoughts are about what approaches at a structural level might help to address some of those challenges. So you've pointed certainly at resourcing as being huge among those. And so I'm wondering if there's other things in addition to greater resourcing that either in your experience or coming from the literature might help us create environments where trust can flourish.
Yeah, well, I was going to say that obviously the simple answer is just increase more resources and have a better functioning system. Obviously, that's a ways away. I don't think we should disregard it completely, however. I mean, I think we do obviously need to keep a constant focus on the fact that we're routinely operating a system at 105 or 110% capacity. And I truly think that if we were able to meet a target bringing down to 85% capacity, I mean, imagine a system where opportunities to see a patient, to collaborate on care is no longer seen as a threat to what's happening within your own silo, but as an opportunity for you to do your job and to exercise care. I would like to think that's not too optimistic of a plan. But knowing, as you say, that isn't really happening anytime soon, I think we have to figure out how to do better with what we have. And we can use the facilitators of trust that I've talked about to think about what some of those solutions might look like. I think some of them are still very big system level solutions, and some of them might be much smaller changes. But all of them, I think, as you say, do have to come at a system or structural level, and we can't have this responsibility shouldered only by individuals to be more quote unquote trustworthy. So with regards to the principle of sort of active collaboration, and this is at a very high level, I mean, we need better alignment around shared goals for patient care. So we need to identify sort of system level patient-centered goals that have shared responsibility between silos, which we do already, but we need to identify, I think, better what elements of those goals each silo has the ability to improve upon. And then this is often an unpopular idea amongst providers, but they're tying some sort of incentive or disincentive to those shared outcomes, not just to isolated departmental productivity, and create kind of open and transparent tracking of progress in in those goals. So again, we do parts of that already for sure, but I think each step is needed to push silos to collaborate and be truly accountable to each other rather than just focused solely on within. Part of that, and maybe at a lower level or more concrete example, is around building cross-silo teams and interdisciplinary teams. So I think we've done a very good job over the years at building interdisciplinary teams within silos, but I think there's still a lot of room to grow that between those silos. There are examples of this. For example, every morning in the emergency department where I work, the trauma team, members of the trauma team come down and huddle with us to look at what are the pressures of the day, the challenges of the day, anything coming down the pipeline. Even if there's not much to talk about, just the presence of those people and the recognition and shared reputation by meeting them face to face has a huge impact. We've seen success with ICU teams that proactively go out to wards to identify patients who are at risk of decompensating before they do that, and to offer some advice and help at how to prevent that from happening and prevent them from ever coming to their ICU. There's hospital outreach programs to long-term care homes, again, that by providing assistance in care and moving outside of the silo, benefit the silo by preventing readmissions to hospital and possibly increasing the speed at which you can discharge people. So when we look at collaboration and how it can actually make your life easier to collaborate with other people is where we're going to find the most success. With regards to improved communication, I'd say we are just starting in this province. One of the major things that's going to help, or that I hope is going to help, in terms of one patient, one record. So a shared electronic system where you can simultaneously, if we're not present, we can at least be synchronous and simultaneously looking at the same notes, the same labs, the same x-rays, the same patient photos even. And that will do a lot, I think, to build trust when we're having phone conversations with other providers. With regards to provision of competent and expert care, we may not be able to do that a lot of the time, but we can at least demonstrate to each other our intention to do so with shared M&M rounds, shared simulation, in situ simulation cases between different services, where we can show to each other what ideal care looks like. And then there's some things that are just as simple but widespread in terms of what the literature has shown in terms of effectiveness. They sound a little bit silly, but if you create physical spaces that providers can meet each other within without having to attend exclusively to patient care questions, it goes a great long way towards building that reputation. I can speak personally to, if I've even just shared a joke or stood around having a cup of coffee with somebody from a different service, the chance that the next time they tell me what they think should happen with patient care, that I'm going to implicitly trust them, as absurd as that may sound, it has a huge, huge impact. So creating those spaces allowing people to physically meet each other can have an effect.
And that's a very comprehensive set of strategies for hopefully starting to craft an abundance mindset as opposed to operating constantly in a scarcity mindset, even while recognizing that resourcing might shift, but how do we change a bit how we're operating within it so it feels a bit different for those who are involved. And this has been an incredibly rich discussion. There's still many things I wish that we had time to pick up on, but our time is coming to a close. So I'm wondering if there's anything else that you want to put on the table or that we haven't chatted about so far.
It's if I can emphasize that one thing, it's that I don't want to dismiss individual level responsibility. Certainly there are bad actors out there sometimes who despite all the resources in the world won't demonstrate trustworthiness. But I don't think it's as much as attribution bias leads us to believe.
I think this discussion has really effectively demonstrated why it can be surprisingly complicated when we're looking to address trust and distrust in the healthcare system. So thank you so much, Frances, for sharing both your knowledge gained through the literature, but also through your experience. We appreciate so much you sharing that time and insight with us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much.
And of course, we also continue to be grateful for production support from Lisbeth Withhold-Nielsen, Kristen Leshko-Skerry, and the team at Dalhousie MedIT. Thanks to Ben Capps for the theme music, and most of all, thank you for listening. Until next time.